I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Can I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
I'm curious.
Could you shut up, Evan?
One thing I was thinking about.
Shut up, Evan.
So there are some rumors out there.
Evan, shut up!
Is it okay if I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
Okay, but can I just...
Shut up, Evan.
I didn't even say anything. Hey, good people. It's Evan Roskatz, and you are listening to Shut Up, Evan, a podcast about gay shit, internet culture, and reproductive rights. I am joined by Shut Up Evan, roving political correspondent Brian Derrick. Brian, how are you and how do you feel about this newly appointed title that I have given you?
I'm feeling great about the title, much better than I feel about the state of our world at the moment, but overall feeling galvanized after things that have happened over the last 24 hours and excited because it's New York Pride.
I wanted to bring you in to sort of give a little bit of table setting and to sort of contextualize the conversation about where we go from here. So to make good on that first part, I think for a lot of us, we saw that there was a draft of the bill that leaked several weeks ago. And so what transpired yesterday, this ruling, it felt inevitable. And yet, I think for so many of us, it still felt shocking nonetheless. Can you sort of talk us through the difference between the announcement a few weeks ago and what happened yesterday and why yesterday is so consequential for our country?
So what happened a few weeks ago was a draft opinion that had been written by one of the Supreme Court justices was leaked, kind of an unprecedented thing in modern times for the Supreme Court. But someone who had access to a draft that was circulating had shared that with the press. And that's what sort of set off a firestorm a few weeks back. It showed that the thinking for the majority of the court was to outright overturn Roe v. Wade, which is the Supreme Court case that guarantees a constitutional right to abortion. And what happened yesterday was the actual decision. So that what we saw before was a draft. The decision came out yesterday and it had the same effect, the same impact that that draft had, which was the five alarm fire we knew that it would be, which was overturning Roe v. Wade, as well as the Casey decision in 1992, both of which had reaffirmed that there was a constitutional right to abortion, even if it had limitations on it. So that is where we are presently. The fight for abortion access now moves to the states.
My understanding is when something becomes the law of the land, it becomes the law of the land in perpetuity. But I think what this shows us is that nothing is forever. Is there precedent as far as laws going into effect and lasting for decades and then all of a sudden being rolled back by the Supreme Court?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you have what some would consider an activist court, like we do right now with a 6-3 conservative majority, they are more bold and more willing to take that further step to reverse extremely old precedents that have governed our society for a majority or significant period of our country's history. Another example would be the New York state gun law that was over 100 years old that was just overturned in this past week. And that was a law that said that New York required you to have a special reason for you to conceal carry a weapon in the state, in a majority of the state, unless you had a specific purpose for doing so, you would not be issued a permit. And the Supreme Court this week just struck down that 100-plus-year-old law, saying that they believe the Second Amendment guarantees a right to carry for self-defense outside of the home, which is the first time that the Supreme Court has said that.
So not only is there precedent, but there's precedent from earlier this week, essentially.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that you can draw a direct line from having an increasingly conservative court to their emboldened decisions to overturn these kinds of precedents. I don't know that we would see the same thing if it was 5-4, or obviously if we had a different majority.
So coming out of yesterday, we saw a lot of reactions on both sides, everyone from Biden to Nancy Pelosi, Megyn Kelly, of course, had something to say, and many other conservatives as well. I'm wondering if there was someone's response to this news, not even necessarily someone in politics, that resonated particularly for you.
Michelle Obama had a really strong response. She put out a statement that I think captured the feelings and impact for a lot of people. I will also point to the dissent. So if you're not familiar with how Supreme Court rulings work, the majority writes an opinion. Somebody, a specific Supreme Court justice, authors a majority opinion. People sign on to that, making it the majority opinion. And then those who disagree can write their own dissent and sign on together, or do separate dissents, or whatever. And I think that also, if you look at some of the highlights from the dissent, that the three, what we would consider liberal justices, wrote, I think that also really captured what's at stake here, and the fact that the court is setting us back 50 years and making women second-class citizens in this country that will not have control over their own bodies in many places. I will also say there are, when these critical moments happen, there are a lot of different perspectives and a lot of hot takes, especially on social media. And I'm a very action-oriented person. And so my immediate thought is always not like, what does this mean? And what's the historical context? But more so, what are we doing? And how can we have a path forward to make this better?
Right. So on that, let me ask you about that, because I think that for a lot of people, they're taking a beat to be shocked, saddened, disappointed, angry, etc. But as we start to work through those feelings and move to action items, I wanted to bring you in because I know that one of the great things about you and your presence in this world, and particularly on social media, is that you're able to sort of provide resources for people to actually, you know, services that people can actually take action and lead to change. For some people, there is a belief that this sort of sentiment of get out and vote has started to become a little bit like thoughts and prayers in response to a school shooting, in the sense that, is that really doing anything significant? And so I wanted to ask you, for those Democratic leaders right now that are saying the path to change is to get out and vote, is that legitimate? Is that the best course of action?
It is the baseline for any course of action. Any path forward from here has to include a intense commitment to civic engagement and to advocating for women's rights, for bodily autonomy, for all people. And that includes voting, but voting is not on its own going to be enough. That is a disappointing call to action from my point of view, to hear, oh, okay, they've overturned Roe. Roe is on the ballot in November. Make sure you vote in November. That is, you are not going to get the results that you're looking for if you show up every 2 years, or even worse, once every 4 years, and vote at the ballot box. And so I do think that the problem there is that you're setting yourself up for failure. If you're telling people, oh, if we go vote, we can change this, because I can tell you right now that even with massive turnout in November, this problem is not going to be solved in the next 2 years. I think this is like a 10-year problem, 6 at a minimum, but I would say more like a 10 to 12-year problem. And so to answer your question, yes, voting is the solution, but it's only one piece of the solution. And there's so much other advocacy and mobilization that has to happen because the threat that we're up against is significant. It is generational. And conservatives have been working toward this for decades.
Your most recent post on social media is centering must-win elections for abortion access at the state level, which are states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, North Carolina, Kansas, and even Pennsylvania. And I'm wondering, can you explain sort of, you know, these people that you put up, their attorney generals, their governorships, justices, state justices, can you sort of explain for people like myself that don't necessarily understand how this all works, the difference between, like, why, I understand it, abortion is now at the state level. What do these votes help potentially secure us?
What we did was we looked at which specific elected offices would have some kind of decision-making power in abortion access moving forward. That could be an attorney general. Dana Nessel is a good example. She is the current attorney general of Michigan in a very competitive re-election fight coming in November. She has said that she will not enforce the abortion ban on the books. It's like a 70-year-old law, I believe, maybe closer to 90 now. I'd have to look. But she has said she will not enforce that ban as attorney general. And so that is a level of discretion that somebody in an elected position has, where we need those types of offices. Governors are able to veto legislation. There are more shades of gray here than just some states are going to have abortion, some are not. Not every state is going to be able to pass an outright ban, especially like purple states. Maybe more moderate legislators are going to hold them back to a certain number of weeks, or are there going to be exceptions for the health of the person carrying the child, for circumstances involving rape or incest, those kinds of things. There are also variations in how the legislation is written. Are there criminal aspects to the regulation that's being passed? Those kinds of things. And so governors are able, in some states, not all states, are able to veto those bills that are particularly egregious. And then you have the Supreme Court at the state level. Each state has its own high court, and they will also make important decisions about how to interpret laws and how to interpret the state constitution and what rights are guaranteed by the state constitution. And so we identified 8 candidates that will have key decision-making power if they win in November to either block bad legislation or in some way protect access for people seeking an abortion.
And just for some brief context, when you say we, you mean Oath, which is the organization that you founded. Can you just explain for our listeners what Oath is and what its goals and objectives are?
I co-founded an organization called Oath after the 2020 election. And the goal was to help people get involved in elections way before it was time to vote. So that can mean volunteering or donating to candidates, either that will represent you or somewhere else in the country. And we have a particular emphasis around issue-based political activism. And so if abortion is the issue that is most important to you, we want to help you find the candidates and the elections that are going to be most consequential for that issue. If it's gun safety, what are the offices and what are the candidates? Who are the candidates that are going to be most important to that? We want to help you make those connections because after the 2020 election, we saw a lot of people getting involved for the first time, but maybe not devoting their resources, time, energy, talent to the most effective or most impactful places or races. And so we want to help optimize that connection so that you can maximize your impact.
For people that want more information, I, of course, encourage everyone to follow Brian Derrick on social media. It's at Brian Derrick, D-E-R-R-I-C-K, underscore. What's the deal with the underscore?
There's a Brian Derrick with no underscore. So what am I supposed to do?
But why wouldn't you do Brian underscore Derrick?
You know, it's been my thing for like I don't know, 10 years.
Well, you know what? Not necessarily. I mean, an underscore kind of sucks either way. So whoever this other Brian Derrick is, it's kind of like, move out of the way. We have a political strategist here trying to like change the fate of our sad country. So
I'm going to DM him and tell him that you said that.
Let him know. Before I let you go, who are you rooting for on RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars 7?
I'm a Jinx stan. Definitely Jinx and Shay. Those are my two for sure. I haven't seen last night's episode, though.
I have seen it, and I have nothing to say about it. Brian, Brian, I want to thank you so much. This gentleman was out until 5 a.m. last night celebrating Pride, and still at the last minute woke up to hop on the mic today because he prioritizes correctly. He knows how to have fun, but also get the job done. Brian, I think on behalf of so many of us, not only do I appreciate the work that you do, but I appreciate you taking the time today to come on and explain for people like me what the fuck is going on and doing it so last minute with such poise. You've done it before. I hope you will continue to do it again. And you just are the best.
It's always an honor. You're my muse. Happy Pride.
Thank you. And I'm going to throw now to today's interview with the great John Early. He is an actor and comedian who first appeared on our screens a decade ago in a guest role as Jenna Maroney's son Jerome on 30 Rock. He went on to have guest starring roles on High Maintenance, Broad City, Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp, Love, Difficult People, Bob's Burgers, At Home with Amy Sedaris, and Los Espookies. He is perhaps best known for his breakout role as Elliot Goss for 5 seasons on Search Party. He most recently starred as Detective Culp in the Apple TV Plus murder mystery comedy, The After Party. That show was recently renewed for a 2nd season. His film credits include Fort Tilden, Other People, Neighbors 2 Sorority Rising, Beatriz at Dinner, The Disaster Artist, Late Night, and Good Posture. He has performed stand-up at various comedy festivals, including Montreal Just for Laughs, Bonnaroo, South by Southwest, Pemberton, Treasure Island, Outside Lands, Riot LA, and Festival Supreme. Along with his frequent collaborator, Kate Berlant, he has just released the new Peacock comedy special, Would It Kill You to Laugh? Co-starring original View co-host Meredith Vieira, which talk about iconic. He is the best. He's a real one. I'm incredibly proud to say I knew him way back when. He is my friend, John Early.
Shut up, Evan.
Well, first of all, hi, it's been a minute.
I know, Evan, it's so good to see you.
It's good to see you too. We knew each other way back when.
I know, I was trying to describe to my boyfriend how we knew each other. And it actually, I do need you to kind of refresh my memory about the short play that we, did you direct me in something?
No. Okay. We were in a class together, you, me, and Ali Stroker.
Was it the collage class?
I think so. My memory also is not quite there with it, but I have this vague memory of the three of us working together on a project in which we had to perform in front of the class.
Because the only class I took with Ali would have been the collage class, because everyone, I think, word got around that that was a very easy A. I mean, the homework was literally to cut out magazine clippings and to paste them on a piece of paper.
Yes. Anyway, good old NYU. I'm really glad I invested $250,000 to that institution.
It's not a real estate scam, I'll tell you that much.
But is it a scam? Before we get into more, let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsor. It's June, which means it's Pride Month.
Happy Pride Month.
Which means, like most months, but especially this month, I'm drinking Can, the queer-founded, cannabis-infused social tonic that I simply can't get enough of. This Pride Month, Can is partnering with Weed Maps to say gay with a star-studded campaign celebrating queer joy and inclusivity, plus cannabis. Their original Pride anthem, Taste So Good, and its accompanying music video bring together a number of notable faces and voices, including Gus Kenworthy, Kesha, Vincent, Patricia Arquette, Hayley Kiyoko, MNEK, Cornbread, Carrie Colby, Georges, Drag Race Season 13 winner Willow Pill, and forever friend of the pod, the legendary Sarah Michelle Gellar. To watch the video and learn where you can purchase Can, head to weedmaps.com/pride-drink-can. And remember, it's Can with two N's. That's weedmaps.com/pride-drink-can. Happy Pride.
Tastes so good.
And we're back. One thing I really value about you is that despite your great success, you remain accessible. For instance, you refuse to pay for a publicist, which I think is a wonderful thing. It allows people like me to get to you quicker. Is it all financial, or is there a part of you that's just like, from my side of things, it's like things get done a lot easier when there aren't managers and publicists in the mix?
When I find out the monthly fee for a publicist, just like, that they keep on generally, not even for like a specific moment of like, I made this movie, I want to promote it, which I totally understand. To just kind of like live indefinitely with a publicist that you're paying like literally sometimes like $7,000 a month. I mean, it's completely insane for them to send one email to like new now next. You can literally go to, if you care that much, go to the fucking new now next Twitter and DM. I don't know. Like, I just don't, if I could see proof that like publicists real, I mean, here's what I think publicists probably do is that they win you awards, or you can get nominated for awards. I think that's probably the only real value. And like, that seems like utterly soul crushing to like devote your life to give away like a year of your life to like attending like events with like, you know, Academy members who are like crusty Academy members. Just so you can get like an award. It seems crazy, but I've never seen the point beyond that. I've never seen any proof that publicists have like any more of an imagination than like me or Kate do, like in terms of like a cool photo shoot idea, you know, like.
Well, it's interesting because it's like I've dealt with situations like very odd requests from publicists. Recently, I had Christina Ricci on the podcast and I reached out to her people in advance and I was like, oh, I'm going to have celebrity call-ins for the show because that's, you know, a signature of this show. And I mentioned that they were like, who is it? And I said, I got Marc Jacobs, Padma Lakshmi, and Devon Sawa. And they asked me if I could cut two of them. They were like, we just don't want to surprise her. And I'm like, they're famous fans of hers calling in. Also, Devon Sawa is a former co-star, and also she's done campaigns for Marc Jacobs. It was like one of those odd things where you wanted to like, I wanted to run to Christina and be like, your people suck. They're like preventing, like, and also I'm not trying to name drop here. We had Anna Faris on last season, and her people made us cut a question that I asked her about having Rosie O'Donnell on her podcast. I just asked about what Rosie was like, and they reached out to me and they're like, can you cut the question about Rosie?
I think it's just to feel like they have a job. God, wow. Well, this is when I was trying to describe you to my boyfriend. I was like, he's a mover and a shaker. You really had this quality very early on. Like, I would like, this is not a surprise to me that you were able to whip to, like, Devon Sawa, Marc Jacobs. And who's the other person you got?
Padma Lakshmi.
I mean, like, that is something you could have done when you were 20.
Well, with having people like you and some of the guests on is like the celebrities I reach out to 99% of the time say yes. You and I just agreed to do this episode days ago and I got worried. I was like, oh my God, because I need to have at least one call in per episode and it has to be someone that I know that knows you. So I went through our mutuals anyway and I got three and they're all big names. And I just think that's like, that's sort of people respond. So we'll get to that.
This is so cool, Evan. I had no idea.
Oh, no. We've had Ariana Grande called in for Cynthia Erivo. We've had Sharon Stone call in for Molly Shannon. But we're gonna keep that train going today. Now, we are taping this right ahead of the final weekend of Gay Pride. And this will air in the home stretch of what often feels like the longest month of the year. Are you pro-Pride? Where do you stand on Gay Pride?
I've never really had a relationship to Pride beyond like a kind of like strictly financial one, which I would say most people's relationship to Pride is about. I would say most kind of entertainers or, you know, a lot of people who maybe pretend to be like advocates it's strictly about like kind of this is the month where you get some like get a nice fat check for a speaking engagement. That's not the case for me. No one asked me to speak on anything, but I do, like, I find that just, like, whenever I'm trying to book a run of shows, people are like, what about the last week in Pride? And I'm like, oh, like I'm like, oh, I didn't even consider it. Like, I'm like, what? Like, it always shocks me. Like, yeah, no, that really tends to help sell tickets if it's like a pride show, you know. I'm like, okay. And you know, so that's the kind of cynical like version of it. The earnest, I've also found like when doing those shows, like it actually is, there is something kind of in the air, you know. People are in a partying mood, and I like doing shows during Pride Month. I've never really had any sort of like relationship as a kind of consumer of Pride events, because I'm, you know, I mean, I think you've always known this about me, like I'm much to my own like disappointment, there's I'm somehow like a little like buttoned up or domestic or kind of Pollyanna, or I don't know, like I just never really go. But last summer, when it was like the summer of love and it was like everyone had been locked up because of COVID, I was in New York shooting Search Party, and I've never done this during Pride. I went like every single night. Did you go to the Madonna show?
Yes, we saw each other.
Yes, we saw each other. Yes, that was the first night. Like, I went to that Madonna show.
That's generous that you call it a show, because we got two songs.
Literally two. It was shocking. But no, it was more just that there was like, you know, good music playing afterward. I danced for 16 hours and it felt so good. And then I was like, I was so tired the next day, but I was like, I'm doing it again. And I like four nights in a row, I danced till like 4 a.m. It was, and I had the time of my life, and I was like, this, I get it now. I get it. I get why people do this. And, but this, I've just had two back surgeries this year. maybe from the dancing, you can maybe track it back to the dancing. So like, I didn't realize it was Pride. I'm not kidding. Like this entire month has just, I've been like laying down in this little corner you can see with my orthopedic pillows. Literally just recovering from my second fucking back surgery within the year. So I have had nothing resembling any sort of Pride.
Well, Pride in that back pillow, I imagine. It's definitely recover.
Absolutely.
One thing I'm always interested in with someone like you who plays so many characters, I mean, in this new special, right, we're like cycling through so many different characters. Do you ever feel a pressure in an interview setting to perform, to be a version of yourself that you sometimes feel perhaps the interview is trying to coerce out of you?
I only have energy to just be like kind of a steamrolling kind of like earnestness, you know, like I don't mean to say like, I'm just me, Evan, like it's just, you're always going to get me at all. I don't mean that at all. I just, what happens is like, I do all these podcasts for, or interviews or whatever, or appearances for like any given project. And you are in this mode of like desperately wanting people to see the thing you worked so hard on, you know? So you're just like, of course I'll do it. Yeah, I'll do this, this, this. And then you get the Google alerts as the things start to come out, and I look at them and I just feel, I'm like, that's how I talk? I don't understand. Like, I thought I was making a really clear point, or I thought I was being funny, and it just looks so cloyingly earnest, and I feel like I'm trying to sound smart. And so I think when I'm in the from that trauma, when I'm in the process of giving an interview, the biggest pressure is coming from myself to either sound smarter or to like be just kind of forget it and be silly, or I'm just like whipping myself. But sometimes I feel that I'm being coerced into some sort of version of myself. That's a very long-winded way of saying yes to your question.
Well, I think it's interesting too, because I feel like a distinction about your comedy and your comedy with Kate is it's smart. I think it is comedy for smart people. And I think that just sometimes when you do something that's smart, describing the thing ends up being sort of like, well, if I have to explain it, then it kind of, it's like if you analyze it too much versus just watching the thing, seeing the thing, doing the thing, experiencing the thing. And I think that can be tricky about doing, I think not just what you're doing in comedy, but any kind of like art. Sometimes an artist is best served by their art, and other times they can create the art and talk about it, but not everyone has, it's a different skill set.
Evan, that's so beautifully put. And more I am like, just let it speak for itself. But then you just want the thing to be seen. And you're like, if this helps get it seen, then I'll fucking talk about it. But like, I'm completely with you. I think I'm most articulate as like an actor. Like I say what I want to say about the world when I'm like doing behavior, when I'm like mimicking behavior. I am unable to say what I want about the state of things in the kind of just pure talking form, and that's okay, and I have to forgive myself all the time. Unfortunately, there is a trend, obviously, in like journalism over the past, I don't know, 10 years of just like, especially with comedians being seen as like prophets and philosophers and like are like truth tellers, you know. It's like there's in such a hilarious way, especially with something like this, like me and Kate are making something that to us is like pure, just like from the heart, silly, funny. Like we are not trying to say anything, you know, but there's still such a pressure from people to be like, I mean, like the hell of making anything while Trump was president was like in the press cycles of like, how is it, like when we did this web series 555, like we made it before Trump was elected, and then it came out in his presidency, and everyone was like, what's it like to make comedy in the Trump era? And we're like, we literally didn't, we'd made this before, like, you know. So there's that. And then I also think there's like a real millennial kind of tendency. I think we all grew up in a kind of like neoliberal education style, which is very much about kind of like, you know, being the best at the job and kind of having a lot to say and like, and never stopping talking, like keep talking, like keep it going. There's like a real style of talking. You might notice I'm doing it now, but there's a real style of talking that like you hear it when you hear like a millennial anchor on like NPR or something. Like and this is what I think Kate is a genius at satirizing, whether she knows it or not, whether it's intentional or not. It's like about just like keeping the floor. You know what I mean? Like keeping it on you. And so you don't really have anything to say, but you're just going to keep stretching it out and like saying synonyms and like, and kind of obfuscating what you're saying in real time. And like, just to like, keep it going, which I feel like is like so part of our like weird, like kind of model UN, like childhoods or something.
I have that tendency as a journalist interviewing a comedian to want to ask them questions about the state of comedy while also recognizing the fact that like, there's not an interesting answer to be gotten from that question. And I'm thinking about Rowan Atkinson just did an interview, and it became a headline, and it said, Rowan Atkinson, he says that comedy's job is to offend. And people did not like that on Twitter, and it started getting quote tweeted. And obviously, it's not that it was taken out of context. It's just not given context, right?
Literally. Of course. It's like, and I assure you, everyone tweeting that did not read the article or the interview.
Not only that, but like, I think he made a valid point, but it was so, if you look at the quote tweets are uniformly, fuck this old white guy.
Mr. Bean!
Hello! Like, show some respect. But also, it's funny because I was talking to Kate recently after her appearance on Marc Maron, and I was saying how much I enjoyed having someone like Marc Maron, who very much is an old straight white guy, interacting with someone like Kate. They sort of exist on very different planes, but I really appreciated Marc sort of investing. He was very confused by Kate at times throughout the interview, but he kept leaning in. Like, he was invested in trying to figure her out, which made for such a fruitful interview. And even though I think that, like, he didn't completely stick the landing, he landed in a place that I was like, this was a really entertaining hour.
That's amazing. I have to listen to it.
Oh, it's really, really good. But I'm kind of just like, I think that often comedians are pressured to give a landscape about comedy in a way that no other profession is sort of like, you know, we don't go to doctors and say, you know, what's the state of medicine? Are we doing good? Is this working out?
Completely. It's so insane. I was just talking to Kate about this the other Rowan Atkinson thing, which is just like, stop baiting like older men, and like, don't ask them questions about cancel culture. Stop. You're creating, you are doing that so cynically.
Exactly. Because I think that there's no answer you're going to get from that question that is going to fulfill a response other than to generate quote tweets of people being angry. It makes me think so much about, not to connect Rowan Atkinson to Trump, but it's like this idea of like, if we would just stop being loud about the things that make us mad, like the people that make us mad, and instead uplift the things that we think are good, I think a lot could shift in our society.
I completely agree.
Let's talk about your Wikipedia bio.
Oh God, I haven't been in a while, actually, I have to say.
So it's two sentences long, and it reads, Early is gay. He has stated that he is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America.
Oh my God.
Which... two truths, right?
Yeah.
If you were to craft the third sentence of your bio, just spitballing here, like, what do you think? What would you add to the bio? Because, I mean, I think there's some stuff missing.
I mean, I would say, like, I'm very kind of, like, dinner-focused. Like, I love restaurants. It's so boring, though. Like, it's so fundamentally uninteresting. But a lot of my life, and Kate's life, too, like, a lot of our lives revolve around... like dinner, like cooking dinner and going to restaurants.
Well, there's actually a recurring bit in your new special, which is centered around what you call it, the theater of being in a restaurant.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if you can give me an example of that, because I think I know exactly what you mean, but I want to hear how you define it.
Okay, so I can give you an example that happened. Like, I'll give you two examples. So one time Kate and I were flown to London to be in Men in Black 4. We were cut from the movie, but we were there for like 14 days or something, and we had nothing to do. Like it was clear that they like hadn't made a decision about if they wanted us to even like shoot the next scene or something. We clearly like bombed. And so we were like stuck in London, which, you know, not a bad place to be stuck. And we, Paris is a very kind of iconic foundational concept for our friendship. It's like the first like little video we made that people really loved was just me and Kate talking about missing Paris.
Do you miss Paris?
Yes.
Thank God you're coming over, because we can talk about this, because I can't talk about it with other friends.
I can't talk about it with other friends.
People are scared.
People here are scared. It's a fear-based culture. In Paris, it's a luxury-based
culture. It's a fear-based culture in America. And it's based in... fear.
Absolutely.
I feel like I was born in Paris.
Oh my God, me too.
I feel like I'm from Paris.
Exactly.
With French guys. You don't know.
You don't know.
That's the thing, is that you never know with them.
You never know.
And it really has since taken on this kind of like philosophical kind of meaning for us, which I think it does for lots of people, obviously, which is like the romance of Paris, but like it never lives up to the romance, and like that's life, you know? But so we were like, oh my God, we're in London. We can go to Paris. And we had obviously, like, you know, I went once when I was like 14 on like a family vacation. And so we went together, and it was immediately exactly, we were like living the joke of the video, which is like, we were completely, it was like immediately not living up to the expectations. Like there was like no air conditioning in this like beautiful kind of romantic boutique kind of old school hotel where they're like, it's, you know, but we were like sweating, we couldn't sleep, you know, and then we were also like completely unable to be in the moment. Like we were like the entire time we were just talking about Paris, but we were like, we're here. And I'm off track, but I'll get there. We had this one moment where we were like in the window of this little suite hotel, looking down on like a street of like Parisians like dining late night. The cobblestones, like it was so gorgeous, and we were like staring out of that, and for like a split second we were just like enjoying the view, and then we turned to each other and we were literally, this is not a joke, we were like, see, no one does this anymore. No one just sits in a window and looks out. Like, everyone's just, we're just always on our phones. And then we, like, heard ourselves and we were like, we are walking parodies of ourselves. Like, and we're literally, like, as we're talking about how no one can be in the moment, everyone's on the phone, we're literally missing the moment that we're referring to, which is, like, looking out on the people. Like, it was so funny. And so we the last night of this trip, we went to this, like, beautiful restaurant, and like it could not be more romantic, and like we were so fucking hellbent on the waitress liking us, and like she, in a classic kind of French way, just like didn't, she was so unmoved by all of our like jokes, and like she didn't
why would she care about our kind of relationship to Paris, or like, you know, or the fact that we kind of spontaneously came from London. It's like, she's not impressed by that at all. And so we were just like trying and failing. And like, cause you know, we want to be the Americans who don't seem like tourists. And so at the end of the, at the end of the meal, after we paid, she literally just said to us, she was like, it was a pleasure, truly. And we were like, she walked away, we were like, did you hear that? We were like, oh my God. We were so excited. We got her. And like, something about that, like, even though I'm sure she says it literally to everyone, we were like, it completely transformed what had been a kind of like a privately crushing trip until we had like fully triumphed. Anyway, that's what dinner is about for us, is like kind of the waiter, us being the waiter's favorite table, you know.
I get it. I mean, especially I see it here a lot. There's so many fun things that you can do to make the experience of a restaurant so much more than just the food. But I really did enjoy that bit, and there's a recurring bit throughout the special of you guys paying the check with hot caramel. Do you say caramel? Yes. Or caramel?
I say caramel because I think that's Southern. I think.
Okay, yeah.
Caramel.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, right? What do you say?
I don't say it out loud a lot is the thing.
No, I know. It always paralyzes me when I start to say it.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are on gay Twitter. I was just interviewing Joel Kim Booster, and we talked about how the more famous he becomes, the less fun Twitter becomes, because it used to be a website you could go on and just talk your shit. And now, especially if you're someone in the public eye, there's more scrutiny around the things you say. Even Ronan Farrow was talking about this too recently when he was on the Hollywood Reporter podcast. And he said, like, when he first started off as a journalist and had 20,000 followers, he could tweet things that, you know, had nothing to do with, you know, Me Too or his journalistic pursuits, just like a stupid, like, I'm making spaghetti bolognese. And now he's Ronan Farrow, right? So he can't, you know, reduce himself to something like that. He can't make jokes about
Satchel.
Oh my God. He can't make jokes about character actresses, you know? Do you enjoy Twitter and gay Twitter?
No, this is I've really, really learned the hard way of, like, you know, as someone who joined Twitter in like 2012, maybe 2011, I don't know, like, truly tweeting from my little Lefferts Gardens like apartment, like trying, like, high as hell, probably on your weed. We won't go further, but like,
but I will say, for those that don't know, and I'm only bring this up because it's relevant, but like, so John and I used to get high together with, I have this volcano. I still have the exact same volcano that I use, but this was what, like 2006 or whatever? And like, I was going to say I was the coolest of the cool. Maybe I should reframe it as I thought I was the coolest of the cool, but it's this giant
bag. Yeah.
It's like a plastic bag that fills with vapor. And that was kind of like what I was known as, I mean, as the guy around Tish that sold weed and had the big vaporizer bag.
I smoked out of that can you even say that? I vaped out of that machine before I saw Robin and Khalees at Webster Hall. Do you remember that? I brought my friend Jenny, and we sucked out of the bag and then stumbled down to see Khalees and Robin. Which was honestly one of the greatest nights of my life.
You made me a CD. Do you remember this?
Beyond Milkshake.
Yes.
An actual CDR?
You made me a CD. You made me a CD.
That's beautiful. Now, what was I? Oh, wait.
Social media, sorry.
Oh, social media. No, when I was, you know, tweeting high out of my mind, a lot of the stand-up I was doing early on was very much just kind of like cultural commentary, you know, like as with many gays, it's like, for some reason, we're fixated on pop culture and actresses and, you know, and so that was very much like my bread and butter, my point of view. I mean, I came by it very earnestly, but like, so I used Twitter obviously as a platform to like kind of try out, make those jokes, you know, and I'm a hater, you know, like I'm, you know, I'm my the fuel for my like kind of cultural criticism, if you can even call it something that lofty, is like hate. It's like a horror, you know, staring out at the, you know, the abyss that is like our totally degraded popular culture. And like, so I don't know, like that just is the kind of stuff I used to tweet and this kind of stuff I used to do on stage. And there were, I didn't even think twice about like saying something about someone famous or like getting in trouble or, you know, but I, as my profile rose, there was like a real like kind of growing period where I was realizing very painfully that I kind of couldn't do that anymore. And I was like, and I would kind of like walk up to the edge a little bit. This is like after I've already been on like two or three seasons of Search Party, you know, which like, you know, certainly not like a household, you know, TV show hit, but like I still, and it's honestly because of that. It's because like some of this, like me and Kate are like little kind of coastal, like niche, like little, you know, we have a little niche rarefied following, and like, and Search Party was always a little boutique kind of like hidden show that no one really talked about, you know? So I've always felt very protected by that. And then sometimes I would go to Twitter and be like vicious about something. And then it would really bite me in the ass. Like I've had one particular, which I will not say who, Evan, maybe I'll text you later, but like I've had one very particular powerful actress who I really, this is what's actually painful about it, is like it's someone who I like deeply admire and like who's very like influential to me. Like I've had, when I, you know, asked her to do something like a couple years ago, like a kind of political, like, you know, fundraiser thing, she like kind of like brought out an old tweet of mine and was like, oh, is this you? And I was like, a tweet where I was kind of like vicious about like something she was in, you know, and like it was devastating. And that's when I, part of me was like, hey, like this is who I am. This is what I do. This is my art. I'm like a, you know, I'm scathing about like certain things in the culture, you know, like I stand by it. But then I also am like, I know what it feels like to fucking see a tweet about you that like hurts, you know, and that like just gets in there and never leaves. Like, so like, I don't blame her, you know, like I don't know, it was very complicated. And then, and that was when I was just like, you know what, I have to stop, I have to kind of grow up and move on. And thank God I had any sort of force, you know, pushing me away from Twitter, because it's such a scary place.
It is. But conversely, I feel like because people like you or Joel scale back, I feel like less funny people are able to put out similar tweets that go viral, and then are able to take those viral tweets and do partnerships for Pride Month with big brands and getting paid tons of money. And so it's just sort of like, I hear what you're saying, it makes total sense, but it's also sort of like, it's an unfortunate aspect of success that actually hinders the thing that perhaps helped you get successful in some ways.
Before we get deeper into it, let's take a quick break and check in with today's sponsor. Can we talk about Sunday Riley? Not only is it the name of not one, but two of my favorite Buffy the Vampire Slayer characters, it also just so happens to be one of my favorite skincare brands. Sunday Riley uses advanced, clinically proven ingredients blended with balancing botanicals for non-irritating, fast-acting formulas. Just because the end of times might be near doesn't mean you can't have great skin. Some of my current obsessions include their global best-selling Good Genes All-in-One Lactic Acid Treatment, CEO 15% Vitamin C Brightening Serum, and their Autocorrect Brightening and Depuffing Eye Contour Cream. As a person with notoriously puffy eyes, the last one is a really saving grace. If you want to visibly improve the look and feel of your skin, look no further than Sunday Riley. Sunday Riley is available at Sephora and Sephora.com. And we're back.
There was a 2018 headline in The Guardian, and it read, "Goodbye, Lena Dunham, Why John Early is Millennial Comedy's New King."
Oh, I hated that so much.
So, I wanted to bring Lena Dunham into the conversation.
Hi, John. This is Lena Dunham. And my question for you is super personal. Do you like to sleep with a top sheet or no? Is your preference a solid quilt or a blanket with a duvet cover? Just give me a sense of your bed setup. Sending love.
Oh my God, the hard-hitting questions.
Yeah, exactly.
From Lena. That is so beautiful. And I feel like, whether she knows it might be subconscious, I do feel like this is kind of an allusion to Paris, the kind of, again, the foundational like text of me and Kate's friendship, which is like, I love how people love to explain that in Paris or like in Europe that there's no top sheet. You know, that's like, oh, they just use a duvet. That's just like a favorite. It's similar to the way people love to tell you that your body's made of 70% water.
Well, also, and speaking of theater, though, there's like the theater of reacting to those facts of like when someone respectable tells you that and you have to sort of perform the wow, that's neat.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what. I, like any sort of kind of American sheep, have just like, I've used a top sheet for years. I love cotton sheets. My boyfriend is kind of like born and raised in Vermont, like really understands how things are made, like how buildings work, how, like, you know, like he understands like textures and like he's like a woodsy boy, you know. And so like he has really helped me understand, like, I'm sure, Evan, that like when we got to New York as like 18-year-olds, like we went straight to Bed Bath & Beyond and got like some crazy ass like polyester sheet that was like $6.99, you know, or the worse, the jersey.
Oh,
the jersey sheets that we're like, it feels like a t-shirt. I was like so seduced by that. I was like, you guys know, it's like your kind of oldest t-shirt, but you're sleeping in it. You know, it's like, and that I've still kind of, I feel like I have a very kind of adolescent kind of like relationship to those kind of things. And Gordon has turned me on to just like 100% cotton, just cotton, like nothing fancy, just like nice cotton, crisp cotton sheets. And so I really like a crisp cotton sheet. I also love a quilt. Lena brought it up. I never knew that about myself, but I'm sorry to my boyfriend. He made me a quilt for Christmas one year, like a really beautiful quilt. And like it is, and I was kind of like, huh, that'll be a nice throw. But like it is actually like there's something, it's very breathable. Like a proper quilt made out of proper materials, it's very breathable. So I use a top sheet and a quilt. Oh, and a major thing, IKEA cooling pillow for the head.
That's the curveball. For those that want to see John and Lena together, you can go on YouTube, search John Early, Lena Dunham. There is a 2015 interview in which John, a version of John, a character that John created, interviews Lena, and it's just, it's a spectacle.
What's up, you guys? I'm John Early, celebrity correspondent for Above Average, and I just got some horrible news about my family. I'm here with Lena Dunham, script coordinator for Showtime's Girls. Lena, what's up?
I'm actually a writer and a director and a producer and an actor on Girls, which is on HBO.
I actually hope you will bring that back.
Evan, thank you. I have to say, to connect this back to what we're talking about, that is one of my favorite things I've ever done. And like, that was a place where I felt like I could be, by kind of making myself the fool in a red carpet situation, I could kind of in a more subversive way, like do kind of gay cultural commentary.
And you know what? There's actually a thread to that moment in your new special, because there's this fabulous moment with Meredith Vieira, one of your co-stars on this special, in which you confuse her for Katie Couric and then also for Diane Sawyer. And in the interview that you do with Lena, you also confuse the name of Girls and whether you call her like a script supervisor on the show, and then you say that's the wrong network, and then she corrects you. And when I heard the joke in the new special, I was like, oh my God, I've heard this joke before. And lo and behold, it is classic John Early. So speaking of that special, kind of dialing it back, you and Kate just celebrated your 10-year friendship anniversary back in May. And John, I distinctly remember being at lunch with you, and you had just met Kate. You had just met her, and you told me that you'd met this person and that you knew that she was your soulmate. And you two have just this unbelievable chemistry. It's entirely evident in all of your work, especially in this special. It's just that sort of finish each other's sentences type of friendship and performance relationship, it seems. How would you describe your relationship with Kate?
Our early friendship was incredibly romantic. And it really did feel like just kind of a twin, like, kind of shocking metaphysical, like, experience meeting each other. And, you know, and we've grown up a lot since then. So, like, we're not literally still sleeping in the same bed, you know, like we were for basically 2 years. But we do what's nice about starting with that level of, like, kind of romance is that you have something to kind of remember, you know, and think about. And sometimes we'll have, like when we did Jimmy Fallon, we got a really nice dinner reservation afterward. Her mom, without telling us, obviously, had paid for a round of, like, Prosecco. And the waitress brought over the Prosecco and, like, was like, "This is from Helen Berland." And we both started crying. and we were like, "Oh my God." That was, like, a moment where I really felt like, oh, this is what's so nice about, like, kind of long friendship, is you can, like, kind of have these very, you can have these ritualistic kind of moments of, like, remembering where you started as friends and artistically too. And I don't know, that's so, yeah, we have a very, we like to kind of every once in a while kind of, like, have a nice dinner and kind of proclaim, like, kind of have a kind of a commitment ceremony, or what do they call it when you renew your vows?
Vow renewal.
Yeah. Vow renewal. I mean, yeah, so that's part of the friendship for sure. And then there's also just, there's an ease. Like, this is just something you can't buy, Evan. Like, when we work together, you know, there are plenty of ways in which, like, when you work with anyone, like, you're spending so many hours together, and we can fall into kind of a sibling kind of like grumpiness with each other. But, like, we also, like, we're literally, when we're working together, like, you know, she's picking me up, like, 4:45 in the morning, you know, and we're exhausted, and, like, we get in the car, and then moment one, it always shocks me, we're, like, screaming laughing. I can't, it's so corny to even describe, but it's just, like, I think what it is more scientifically is that Kate and I like to be kind of, like, out of it. You know, like, I think we really have a very, our friendship is predominantly, like, us just kind of like, blah, blah, like, you know, like, us driving places together for work or, like, for pleasure, and just, like, kind of, like, staring out the, you know, it's like, I think we often remark on, like, that is actually the key to a successful relationship or a partnership, is an ability to be, like, just totally dumb around each other, and to be around someone for hours where literally you're just, like, on your phone and you're completely relaxed and there's no pressure to be like, "How are you?" you know, which is, I think, what we find so funny about, like, doing that comedically, is, like, things that aren't relaxed, like, things that are a little more, like, fraught, you know, because it's what we have is just more, a little more in the bed.
Quite literally for 7 years. Not like it sounds that. Like. Although I did love that segment about the two of you with the, that addresses the intrinsic romantic chemistry with the two of you. So in this new special streaming now on Peacock, there is a recurring segment throughout moderated by the great Meredith Vieira, original cast member of The View. Bring her back, please. In which you and Kate are reuniting 30 years after your friendship ended to suss out what went wrong.
You know, it's so funny. Obviously, I haven't seen you in years.
Yeah, I know. Years.
You know, I haven't seen you in person.
Yeah, years.
I haven't seen you in person, but I also haven't seen you just kind of reflected anywhere in the culture. So what have you been up to?
I've been really good. I've been busy. I've been in New York doing theater. Kind of a first love of mine, but mostly I'm busy with my foundations. That is really what keeps me occupied.
You have foundations?
Yeah, I've started many foundations, and that's where I really pour my energy.
What foundations?
My foundations.
Which ones?
It's a lot of work, but it's so worth it.
Which foundation? Name one.
Which foundation would I name? Do you see?
Just start one of them. Yeah.
Just which foundation, you know? And if you come down to the office.
Irish. Which foundation?
I didn't go Irish at all with that. Okay. I didn't go Irish when I said foundation.
Now she's fully Irish.
It's based on a 2012 Three's Company reunion with Suzanne Somers and Joyce DeWitt. In preparation for today, I rewatched that interview. It is must-see TV, but only for people like us. And so I'm wondering if you can explain what it was about this moment, which is, for so many people, going to be just a very innocuous, like, you know, just a simple reunion, but you saw something in it. I think I'd like to say I saw the same thing. What is it in that interview? What happens? Because not a lot happens, but a lot happens.
They're just, I mean, like, quite simply, like, they're just, like, on a physics level, they're just, like, saying the opposite of what they feel. You know, like, and there's, like, a clear tension and resentment and, like, anger in the room, but they're, like, gripping each other's hands.
Yeah.
It's like the tightest hug I've ever seen, ever. Like the, and we for time had to cut the hug in our special. Like we did a full sequence of like, the first cut of the special was an hour and 16 minutes and we had to get it down to like 50. So like there was like a full sequence of me and Kate holding hands and Kate and I gripping each other in a hug and her being like, you gotta let go. and like you can see like our nails like digging into each other, like, so like that was, there's tons of stuff like that that unfortunately had to go. But yeah, there's also like a kind of, there's this kind of reworking of their past, which I think is very human and very sad and sweet, the way like Joyce DeWitt is talking about like never getting never being comfortable. I was never comfortable with the fame. And Suzanne Somers actually in a kind of like refreshing way was like, really? I loved it. And Joyce, I said, never comfortable with it. Never comfortable with it. And there's like an intensity too. There's like a lot of like she grunts a lot, Joyce DeWitt, in the video. And we took that, we really took that very liberally in our special. She does a lot of like, yeah.
There's also this expectation, I think, from Suzanne, because it's on Suzanne's show. She had a talk show at the time. There's an expectation that we, the audience, understand the context, which we don't. Like, we understand they haven't seen each other in 30 years, and we can sort of deduce as to like why. But there's a lot of subtext that I think that they expect the viewer to be privy to, which we're not, which I think enriches the viewing experience.
Yes. I also think very quickly that just, like, Kate and I fundamentally love, like, when people think it's a good idea to like have a vulnerable moment on camera, like I will, like it is, it, I mean, and similarly, I think that's like sometimes our feeling about just like weddings, like just like obviously I've been to very beautiful weddings of people I love and respect. It's like, you know, of course, but like some, there is a part of me that's always like, I can't imagine like being in love with someone and wanting to be like, let's take it to the streets. Like, let's show people. Like, let's hold each other's hands and like get choked up. And like, trust me, I've gotten choked up watching that, you know, both in real life and on like The Fucking Bachelor. You know, I'm not saying I'm above that. But like, I do think there's something fundamentally strange about kind of like making people witness these like really private emotions. And so that's, I think there's something kind of like weirdly abusive in a meta way about the Joyce DeWitt, Suzanne Somers video, where it's like, we're like watching something that's actually very emotionally like fraught and intense for both of them. And they chose to do it and put it on the internet. It's very weird.
Can't get enough of Shut Up, Evan? I don't blame you. That's why you have to check out our Patreon. It's patreon.com/ShutUpEvan, where you will be able to find advanced access to interviews, bonus episodes, video clips from the interviews, cut for time questions, and so much more. You don't want to miss out. I am fully committing to making the Patreon a much more robust experience for season 3. So again, www.patreon.com/ShutUpEvan.
So you actually replaced Adele, the legendary Adele, for a gig in 2018, which reminds me that a friend of yours wanted to submit a voice memo.
No.
Hi, this is Amy Schumer, and I'm calling with a question for one John Early. John, I guess my question for you would be, whose was your favorite ever wedding to officiate?
Ah! It would probably have to be the only one I've ever done, which was her wedding. That I love, she really sounds like she's in bed. She's that kind of croaky, like, morning voice.
I love the aesthetics of just like hearing what famous people sound like when they're not like in like famous person mode. It's gratifying. It normalizes us non-famous folk. Not you, me. Yeah. So can you chair. I guess, yeah, it's an odd thing to get a call to replace Adele.
It wasn't even a call, it was a text.
Oh, okay.
It was like, it was so surreal. Like, she clearly had a sense of humor about the whole thing, hence asking me to do the wedding, like last minute, kind of via text, being like, you want to do it? You know? And then, but I was scared, I think, as anyone would be, of just like, this is obviously a very special day for her and Chris, her husband, and I don't want to like fuck it up. And then on top of that, I don't want to fuck it up in front of Lauren Hutton. You know, like there were so many famous people there. It was really quite scary. And anyway, and then the next morning she texted me like, will you do it as Vicky, a kind of Christian Southern stand-up mom character I have. And that is when I actually felt just a little bit less scared, because I was like, okay, now I have some sort of angle. I know how to write this. There's a character, you know, she's expecting it to be funny, versus if it was just me up there, I would say she would be expecting maybe a little bit more sincerity. I don't know. I'm sure she was always expecting funny, but like this really clarified it for me.
It's funny you say that, because it's like my instinct would be like, the second that I have to do a character, that would make me so nervous. But I love that in your mind, it's like that sets you at ease, the fact that you've been given an assignment on top of just be yourself.
And it helped me, wouldn't you believe it? Like it helped me be more sincere. Like having the character helped me like actually write stuff that was more meaningful. Like if I was up there as myself being like, you know, like when Amy first met Chris, you know, like it would have been hell. But like Vicky really helped, because Vicky is like the point of Vicky is that she's like a really funny, but she's also really sweet. Like people love Vicky, I mean the character, you know, like, so she kind of allows me to be maybe more earnest than the John persona, whatever that is.
I'm gonna name some people, some of whom you've worked with, some of whom are just random celebrities, and I just want to free associate. So first, Jane Krakowski.
I owe her everything. Just like, she is someone I always forget. I really appreciate you bringing her up, because she is someone who I always forget to cite as like an influence. Precision. I'm not saying I'm capable of that. I say I aspire to that level of precision. We all kind of have been for the past 15 years in culture, just like fetishizing kind of like messiness or like quote unquote vulnerability. And like, I just love how razor sharp she is.
Kristen Johnston.
Just one of the greatest actresses of all time, like really kind of untapped as a dramatic actress. Really makes me weep. When I first came to New York and was at Atlantic Theater Company for, you know, through NYU, she was a teacher there, and I saw her in this play Scarcity by Lucy Thurber.
Yes.
Did you see it?
I saw it too.
Oh, she just, seeing this woman who's like a rubber band, who's like so goofy and tall and such a big presence, like seeing her like weep in like a Walmart uniform, I was like, it really changed something for me. And I really deeply love her, and I want to see her do everything.
Little bit of a 180, John Travolta.
Ooh, see, with men, you bring up a man and I go blank. I mean, I love the gif of him, like whatever that movie he did with Jamie Lee Curtis, that everyone's always using that gif of him like kind of moving his hips.
I know exactly what you're talking about. It's disgusting that we don't know this.
It's like,
yeah,
deeply unsettling. He's like really sweaty. It's so hot. Like,
I know.
In a kind of Fosse way, like the hips are very like sexual and Fosse. And like, so
someone's listening
say,
to this
like,
podcast right now shouting the name of that movie. It's my favorite thing about
podcasting. I know. we cannot hear them. I would just say like, yeah, I really appreciate that kind of star, like a kind of a star of a different generation, where like, A, you can like dance. You're like when men were expected to dance, for that to be in your like repertoire, like that is something I really, really miss. And then I also just like that level of fame, like it will never have like stars like that anymore, who are like so globally famous.
It's funny because a lot of people on Twitter are like, oh, I can't believe that people are like seeing Top Gun Maverick. And I'm like, because Tom Cruise is a kind of celebrity that it's like that Michael Jackson type celebrity that we're not accustomed to because there are so few of them. And the ones that we have work so infrequently because they do not need to. But like Tom Cruise is not a regular star. Like he does not need attention. What he does is the standard, right? And it's like John Travolta similarly, where it's just like it's a... Yeah, I want to say it's a dying breed, but it's almost just... But it's not, right? Because if he was able to do Top Gun and come back, it can exist still. Well, yeah, I guess that's dying, right? It's not dead, it's dying. So yes, dying breed.
Yes.
Dying
breed. Well, no, Top Gun is proof that, like, we do crave, like, agreement. You know, like, we've all been kind of trained over the past... I keep giving this, like, a... you know, hazy number, whatever I'm referring to, just whenever everything got horrible. But like, you know, we've all been trained to think that like we just hate each other and that we're gonna always be fighting and that like if you believe this, you know what sign I'm talking about, what yard sign I'm talking about. It's like, then you can't possibly believe this or this. It's like things like Top Gun, I'm sorry, are proof that like we do want to experience like giant kind of grand narratives together. We can there is such thing as like tapping into the universal, and like everyone who was there, I mean, I saw dads and sons at fucking Top Gun like walking out arm in arm. It was the sweetest thing I had ever seen, and I was like, I'm sorry, like, and yet we spend all of our time on Twitter talking about how men are so out of touch with their emotions and masculinity is so toxic. And it's like, and I was like, I don't know. Like, did you go to Top Gun? Yeah. Like, it was really fucking sweet.
The power of the cinema. Okay, last one. Our deity of sorts, Lisa Kudrow.
An unintentional, like, philosopher. like just like her work is so deep. And I don't think she even tries to make it so, which is really a good lesson. I mean, okay, I'll say this. This is like a story from my childhood. I remember showing my mom Romy and Michelle because I was like completely just, I couldn't stop watching it as a kid. And I was like, it wasn't just that it was so fun and colorful and funny. Like there was something like deeply kind of like religious about it and like seductive. I couldn't figure it out. And I remember showing like my mom a scene, you know, the scene between who you guessed it, Romy and Michelle. And I was watching the way Lisa Kudrow was reacting to Mira Sorvino. She was talking and like she was just kind of like her face was just kind of limp. Her mouth was like kind of open, just like kind of mouth breathing, you know, and not doing anything. She wasn't going, huh! For the listener, I'm smiling with wide eyes, you know. She's just kind of like dead faced. And I was like, isn't that so weird? I was like, you know, mom, don't you find it so crazy? She's like not, like, it's like weird listening or something. I was like calling attention to it. And my mom was like, well, you know, like, I think when you're really listening to someone, you're like not thinking about the way your face looks. And I was like, oh my God. It was like truly like changed my life. I was like, that is the best acting advice I've ever gotten. She seems just very deeply like kind of humble. I don't know. And therefore, she doesn't assert any sort of, like, narrative on the public of her, like, the greatness of her body of work. There's plenty of gays, like, building the Kudrow monuments as we speak. But, like, myself included, I drew the fucking blueprints. But I do think, like, there is a real, like, her body of work, I think, is, like, very profound, is all I'll say.
Okay, I want to bring on our last guest.
Hi, this is... Adam Pally. I have a question for John Early, big fan. How do you keep in shape on set? You know, you're shooting. I mean, you at this point, John, you must have more days in front of the camera than off. So it must be hard to not only maintain like a mental stability, but a physical stability as well. I just want to know a little bit about what your routine is.
That was genius. That was genius.
I know. And he was like, is this okay? I was like, yeah.
That is so fucking funny. God bless him. I'd like to ask him the same question. Oof. I mean, he is so fine. I don't, which I think is kind of is implied in the question. I don't do anything.
I've made perfectly clear, I've had two back surgeries in the last year because I don't take care of my body. It's so far out of the realm of my life that I don't even have the vocabulary to make the joke. I will say that, like, having these back surgeries and doing physical therapy has made me very conscious of the core.
Two last questions. There is a Twitter campaign begging to have you and Kate Berlant cast in season 2 of The White Lotus. It has 78 likes as of this recording. I believe they have wrapped production on season 2, but if season 3 came knocking and those 78 likes ballooned to 78,000, would you consider?
Yes. Like, we want to be the evil, like, ants. And I mean aunts, not ants, but I'll be an aunt as well, but, like, I really, like, we want to be in, like, kids' movies where we're, like, the villains, you know?
I could see, I know they're shooting Paddington 3 right now, but Paddington 4, I feel like you and Kate would be fabulous villains. In the same vein as Nicole Kidman's villain turn in Paddington 1. Have you seen Paddington? I just saw it for the first time.
Only 2, which everyone loved.
So you haven't seen the Nicole Kidman one?
I literally had no idea she was in it and that she plays a villain. That sounds like heaven.
I didn't know either. I'm literally watching. I was at home with family. We're like, oh, let's put on this movie about a bear. And then all of a sudden, Nicole Kidman appears. And I'm like, holy fuck, I'm buckled in. Okay, speaking of viral tweets, I want to end on this. This one actually did go viral. It's from the handle at Soapy Hadid, which is a fabulous handle. And it reads, John Early and Kate Berlant low-key invented a lot of you. A follow-up tweet reads, queer elders for real, which is somewhat shady. But I'm just wondering, and that tweet got thousands and thousands of likes, and I'm wondering what you make of that tweet, because I think there's a reason for its virality.
I've heard that a lot over the past 5 or 6 years or something, and it's always incredibly flattering. However, I don't think it's has anything to do with me and Kate, and I think it has everything to do with the fact that I was completely doing Variety Shack, like Chelsea Peretti, Andrea Rosen, Heather Lawless, Shanali Bomek. Like, I was doing them on stage when I first started doing stand-up. I was doing Kate. I was doing Margaret Cho. You know, I was doing Sarah Silverman. When you first start doing comedy, you're just trying on people's voices until hopefully it synthesizes into something that's a little more, like, integrated and more you. And, like, but I thankfully was doing that in the quote-unquote privacy of, like, actual real rooms, like, with no cameras there. And I think everyone who's coming up now who has seen me and Kate on the internet, seen our videos or whatever, seen us do stand-up, maybe, like, probably not, though, they're trying things out for the first time on a phone and putting it on the internet. So, like, it gets immediately seen in a way like it wouldn't in previous kind of generations of comedy. So, like, I also think Kate and I just, I think, maybe hit a cultural nerve on a platform maybe first, but I think a lot of people our age were absorbing the zeitgeist in the exact same way we were, and we're kind of digesting it in the same way we were and regurgitating it back out in the exact same way we were, but we got lucky enough to have, like, a kind of platform for it. So I think those are my thoughts on it, and it's very flattering.
I would rebuttal only a little bit to say, I imagine, yes, I can agree with you. There is some level of luck to it. But I also think that, like, you two have a particularly elevated skill set that is not, it's not as though there were, like, a ton out there and you two just happened to be the ones that got it. I think there were a small number, and perhaps you were the first in the door, but I don't want to discredit the idea that I think what you and Kate have always done and continue to do is in its own lane. And one of the great things I love about this new special with you and Kate is that it feels both very familiar for longtime fans of yours, but there are new comedic beats struck. And so it's able to sort of do that tightrope dance. As I said earlier, like the joke with the Katie Couric, Meredith Vieira, Diane Sawyer, that's a comedic beat that I've seen you hit before, but you did it in a new way. And so I think that I hope that you see, maybe it's not even valuable to see it, but I hope you understand it's like, yes, luck, but there's other alchemy here.
That is incredibly sweet. And I will also say, like, what excites me about this special is, like, It gives me and Kate a chance, because people do kind of tell us, we get tweets like that a lot, and people, you know, maybe like resentfully tell us about like it in green rooms sometimes too. And like, sometimes I'm like, I see what you're saying, but also I do think a lot of people who maybe think they're doing us or like, or lovingly, you know, doing us or can't help but be influenced, whatever. It's like in the way that I can't help but be influenced by my heroes, whatever. I'm not to say I'm a hero anyway, moving on. But I think a lot of people mistakenly think that Kate and I are always doing some sort of cultural commentary together. And like, I think maybe we do that unintentionally a lot, but to us, it's like the primary, like what we like to do is like behavior, like psychological dynamics and behavior. And like, we like to like fall on our faces and like trip downstairs. It's like so what I love about this special is it gives us an opportunity to like actually just like properly act in scenes together instead of like this kind of maybe more crude like interpretations of what people think we do, which is some sort of like cult, like mimicry of like millennials, like of like entitled millennials. Like that's never what we set out to do, but that's always what people write about us, you know? And so like, I really, to us, it's just like, we just love to like choose a kind of dynamic and live in it for like 12 minutes, you know? And like, so I think that's what really excites me about the special.
Well, I cannot encourage people to check it out. It is streaming now on Peacock.
Peacock.
Peacock, yeah. John, I have to thank you so much. It's funny, this is such a unique experience in that this is the longest conversation we've had in many, many years, and we're the same people, and yet we're different people, and it's so cool. It's almost like in a funny way. This is almost like the Joyce DeWitt, Suzanne Summers, in that like we're reuniting after a long time. But we also have this funny vantage point of like being able to see each other on the internet and like check in with each other in that way. So anyway, but it's very rewarding to speak to you now. And I'm really grateful that you stayed yourself. And you're still the John Early that I knew at NYU and loved then. And I'm really, really proud of you and happy for all your successes.
Evan, thank you so much. It really means the world to me. And I would just like to confirm for the fans that Evan is the same. Evan has nothing has gotten to his head. You are just still wise beyond your years, incredibly charismatic. And it's an honor.
Thank you. Thank you. That's so kind.
Shut the fuck up, Evan.
Evan, shut up.
Shut up, Evan.
Shut up, Evan.
Shut up, Evan.
Shut Up, Evan is produced by me, Evan Ross Katz, with audio editing by Sophia Asmuth and social media by Griffin Dunn. Shout out to our Patreon subscribers for their financial support, and thank you to you all, the listeners, for helping us keep the lights on.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.